From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission.
Excelsior.
Redwood City.
American Canyon.
San Francisco.
Vallejo.
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, San Francisco officials are sweeping homeless people away.
I'm not gonna go sleep on no mat when I can go sleep in my Airbnb in my tent. I'm not gonna sleep next to no stranger.
Where will they live now? Then we'll hear how an Oakland trauma therapist supports his fellow psychologist through a podcast.
I remember interviewing one really seasoned guy, and he was like, you know what, if you're not affected or impacted by what your client is telling you, something's wrong.
And we find out the answer to this week's audiograph mystery sound.
It's a very zen experience.
That's today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. When the rain arrived this winter, so did a line of tents along Division Street beneath the Central Freeway in San Francisco. Dozens of people living close together on the sidewalk without permanent housing. The Rainbow Grocery Cooperative is right by the tents. Notices posted in the store ask customers to contact the city about the growing homeless community around them. On Tuesday, the Department of Public Works arrived with dump trucks and posted signs saying the area is in violation of health codes and that tents had to be gone within 72 hours. So why are there so many more campers in tents this winter, and what will happen to them next? KALW's Liza Veal and Jeremy Dalmas bring us this report.
This morning, Division Street under the freeway was still lined with tents. It seemed tidy, maybe because it was early and the Department of Public Works had just finished their morning sweep.
They came by, and they cleaned that side up, it went well, no problems.
Perry Foster says he's been camped here for a couple of months. He thinks the effort to disband the encampment is pointless.
I think the majority of us will stay. They're only gonna do what they always do, either, you know, toss your stuff or ticket you.
On Tuesday, the city declared the encampment a public health hazard. Since then, city workers have taken away a dump truck full of waste each day. They filled a flatbed full of people's belongings, taken it to storage, and bagged and tagged it so people can come get it later. People on social media have accused them of trashing people's possessions without permission, though Foster says that's not what he's seen.
DPW has been wonderful. It's not DPW at all, nor is it really, the police. It's not an adversarial situation as one would think.
Still, the city wants people off the street by Friday so it can be fully steam cleaned. Foster says he's tired of packing up and moving, though, so he'll stay put and test his luck.
It'd be interesting tonight to see if they try to be more assertive. You know, tonight would be interesting to see how they play out.
All homeless encampment tent owners, based upon the findings of...
This is Boston Bisbee reading one of the city notices to vacate.
It was determined that the homeless encampment set up on Division Street is insanitary due to accumulation of garbage, human feces, hypodermic needles, urine odors, and other insanitary conditions, and it is hereby declared as a public nuisance.
Bisbee says she's been living in a tent for a year, and she says she's not homeless. She's camping.
I'd be homeless if I wasn't in a tent, to be honest with you.
Homeless encampments move around the city, but this one seems to be the largest in recent memory. The only other comparable examples are the famous St. Agnes encampment of the 80s and the tent cities during the time of Occupy SF.
We've had people living outside our stores for years. The issue is that it's getting to a point where, as we said, it's become a public health and safety hazard.
Dennis Wagner is CFO at Rainbow Grocery down the street. They and other neighbors have been trying to get the city to address the issue, but he is conflicted about the sweeps.
We can't really fault the city for declaring it a 72-hour emergency to clean the streets, because the streets need cleaning. We don't agree with the idea of removing people and shoving them to the next corner.
Tension around the encampment has been building for weeks. So what exactly triggered the public health emergency?
What our crews have seen, who are out there cleaning the streets every day, is that there has been a large amount of urine, feces, disposed of needles on the ground.
Rachel Gordon with the San Francisco Department of Public Works says, one, homelessness is up a little bit this year. Two, the rain came hard this winter. And three, there was a huge push by charity organizations to get tents to people on the street. And that's what made the clusters really stick.
We've also seen that with the proliferation of tents on Division Street and some other streets as well, that the sidewalks were being blocked, and we started to see a lot of pedestrians, whether they're walking or in wheelchairs, have to go out into traffic, and that's a dangerous situation.
Gordon says the city's not trying to clear homeless people from the area permanently, because that would be impossible.
Can we point to any examples where there's any kind of lasting impact from cleaning up a site like this?
Well, so two blocks of Division Street have lasted for 2 days now of being clean. We're on day two. They have.
This isn't something that's going to be solved easily or quickly or once and for all. This is not going to end come Friday.
Sam Dodge is director of the mayor's office on homelessness. He says the sweeps won't make the encampment go away, but they will de-escalate the situation. He says the city can't allow people to live under the conditions at the encampment. This is an attempt to offer an alternative.
They need much more than just a tent. At the minimum, we need a safe, secure place to sleep. We need social work to help navigate our system of bureaucracy to get entitlement benefits and to move on with their lives.
Can we really ask the people that are camped out on Division Street to relocate to shelters? Like, do we really have the capacity to absorb the people that are there?
We do have 55 spaces at Pier 80 that are still available. 95 people have come in off of the Division Street area in the past week and a half into Pier 80. And so it's shown to work for many people.
Pier 80 is the city's temporary homeless shelter on the border of the Potrero Hill and Bayview Hunters Point neighborhoods. Pier 80's only been open for a week and a half. Dodge says every day they invite people from Division to come make longer-term reservations at the shelter, stick around, get set up with a social worker. But they haven't been able to fill the beds with longer-term reservations, so every evening they take in people just for one night. So every night they're at capacity, and every morning there's room again. And here's where the situation gets more complicated. People like Tamara Hoffner don't want to leave.
I'm not gonna go sleep on no mat when I can go sleep in my Airbnb in my tent. Nothing gonna sleep next to no stranger.
And Boston Bisbee says that shelters downtown have lines and Pier 80 is too far for many people.
It's the distance thing, you know what I mean? A lot of these people make their money downtown.
So where will Bisbee go when she has to leave? She already has another tent set up in the southeastern part of the city.
Right on the water, away from everybody. So I don't wanna give the location because sooner or later everyone's gonna start migrating over there.
Tomorrow, the city says the area must be clear. As of now, officials say they don't have a plan for people who don't comply. For Cross Currents, I'm Liza Veal.
That story was co-produced by Jeremy Dalmas. We got a question about the tents on Division Street through our Hey Area project. That's KLW's collaborative reporting initiative that asks what you want to know about the Bay Area. If you want to hear more reporting on what's behind new tent cities in San Francisco, cast your vote right now at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Many people become homeless after suffering trauma, like war veterans, victims of violence. Those are the people Guy McPherson tries to help. He's a trauma therapist from Oakland who spends many hours a day, all week, talking to people who've gone through life-changing accidents, marital abuse, war, some of life's hardest things to talk about. Hearing about pain and suffering over and over takes a toll. And Guy says many of his colleagues feel the same. They needed an outlet to be heard, so he started the Trauma Therapy Podcast. Guy McPherson came by our studios, and I asked him first what inspired him to become a trauma therapist.
My brother was a Navy SEAL who came back from Iraq with PTSD. This was several years ago. And when he came back, I was like, you know, so excited. What did you do? I want to hear the details. I want the gritty. And he was just like, you know, giving me kind of the hand, the open palm, you know, like, I just kind of don't want to talk about it, don't want to deal with it. And I kind of took that as a kind of being dismissed. I was like, what are you, this went on and on. And yet I bugged him and I nagged him. And it was only later when I started, and at that time I didn't know anything about PTSD. And it was only later when I first started learning about psychology that I was like, oh my God, I just blew it. And that really kind of inspired me to get into this field. And I was like, at that moment, I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to help people in this type of situation. And I knew I could. And then I went back to school. I went back and got my undergrad and went back to my graduate school to get my PhD in psychology. And as, you know, I did internships and so forth, driving a lot, commuting. And I'm like, as I'm driving, I'm thinking all the time about my clients. What should I have done? What did I do? I don't know what the heck I'm doing. And then I was wishing I'd had like a master therapist right there beside me to mentor me, to guide me. And at the same time, I'm listening to all these podcasts of other people like yourself interviewing people who are doing amazing things with their lives. And I'm like, wait a minute. Maybe I can interview people too, you know? So that was it. So I like started the Trauma Therapist Project, and then I started the podcast, and I like out of the blue started emailing people to see if they would do it. And one thing led to another, and you know, it's really been amazing.
And so you reached out to this community of fellow trauma therapists, and you talk to them and you share ideas and you listen to them. What does that do for you, and what does that do for them? It seems like it's therapy for the therapists.
Yeah, in a sense it is. My goal really is to squeeze as much inspiration out of them as I can. Because it's so cool to talk to people, again, who've been in this field for so many years, and they seem to be the ones who can say, you know what? I didn't know what the heck I was doing, and I made this mistake, and I made that. They're not scared.
How does that make you feel then when you hear those?
It makes me feel like I'm not alone. It makes me feel excited. It makes me feel excited because, you know, talking about trauma is freaky. It's scary for a lot of us. And I was listening to, I remember interviewing one really seasoned guy, and he was like, you know what, if you're not affected or impacted by what your client is telling you, something's wrong. Okay, because this gets us at our core. Being impacted by trauma.
Because one assumption about a trauma therapist might be, you've heard so many horrible things over the years that you are now desensitized.
That's called burnout. That's called burnout. And you cannot be effective as a clinician. Because first and foremost, it's being able to be present, be with someone openly, honestly, and one of the really inspiring individuals I've had on the podcast, Peter Bernstein, who has a facility up here in Marin, he said, you know, you have to realize that you're no different from your clients. And that really stuck with me because, you know, when you get into this field, you get educated and, you know, you're a therapist and then you've got all these degrees and you wear this hat. But oftentimes that gets in the way of the simplicity of instilling hope, the simplicity of being able to metaphorically, in a sense, reach across and hold that person's hand, or even sometimes literally, depending on what types of interventions you practice, but seemingly so simple, but yet very difficult because we're humans and we're impacted, and that affects or can affect how I'm going to interact with you if you're a client.
So what do you do when you go home? Do you try to forget it all, or is it still in your head?
You can't forget it. I mean, it's almost like you have to compartmentalize, because I know that there have been times when I don't know, I'll be talking to my wife or we'll be watching something and something will come up that'll make me think about something. And I think to myself, okay, I could talk about X, but I don't. And I think that utilizing that kind of boundary in a sense is helpful. You have to. I remember one woman I interviewed, Linda Curran, who was amazing. She said that you have to. I remember I asked her about her, how she took care of herself. And she rattled off literally like 8 things she did regularly. And I was so impressed with that.
Do you remember some of them?
You know, walking, hiking, meditating, talking to friends, mm-hmm. you know, sitting down, but doing this consciously with an awareness. And I think that's also very important.
And what about you?
What about me?
Because it sounds like self-care is especially needed in your line of work.
It really is. For me, you know, it's exercising when I can. It's hiking when I can. It's hanging out with my family when all the time, really. Laying on the floor with my 7-month-old. Again, making the concerted effort to create a boundary, make that distinction. So, and that, I have to say, that's a work in progress, too. So,
at any point, do you feel like, I just can't take this anymore, I can't do this anymore?
Well, you know what? The part that I get to do is I get to, again, squeeze the inspiration out of these amazing clinicians and thought leaders and therapists. That, to me, is the great work. I mean, I have a full-time job in a clinic where I work, but being able to sit down and just get so inspired, that gets me going. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this, because there was a part of this field that I was like, wait a minute, I want to talk to other people who are going through this process, like be a connector, like be a joiner in a sense. So I'm getting to do that.
Guy McPherson is a trauma therapist and host of the Trauma Therapist podcast. Find a link to it at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. Now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you a sound that a lot of people find very soothing.
I walk my dog around here, and I saw that they had free lessons, and I just love the space. It's a very zen experience.
Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? We sent KALW's Ian Lewis to Golden Gate Park to tell us more.
There are certain places in San Francisco that make you feel far away from a bustling metropolis, and this is one of them. It's 9 in the morning. I'm watching a group of men with long fishing poles wade out in water up to their waists. They're fly fishermen, the kind you'd likely find in a cold mountain stream, but here, we're far from the nearest river.
My name is Mehrdad Saberi, and we are at the Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club.
Since 1938, this club has given people who love to fly fish a place to practice, right here in the city.
I come here to do what I enjoy a lot, which is casting fly rods.
He's talking about getting a tiny, almost weightless lure, the fly, to land exactly where he wants it. Saberi makes it look easy, but really, being good at it takes lots of training and constant practice. Saberi says I can talk to him while he casts, but first, in order to know what fly fishing is really like, he wants me to take a lesson.
Today, you, Ian, are going to join me, Willie George, and we're going to learn how to fly cast. I'm going to help you a little bit. Is that cool?
That sounds good. Willie George is the president of the Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club. And like any great club, this one has a great clubhouse. Framed displays of handmade flies hang on the wall next to taxidermied fish. But today, we're here for the pools. 3 rectangular concrete ponds. The only fish in these pools are tiny minnows. Those are to keep the mosquitoes down, not to catch. In fly fishing, though, if you're only interested in the fish, you're in the wrong sport.
I'm just here to work on my stroke, you know, like golfers do. It's the same thing with fishing, you know.
Paul Evans has been fly fishing for more than 30 years, and even he's come for a lesson today.
Because most of the time, we're all so damn polite today, we never tell each other what we're doing wrong in any walk of life. You never walk up to a fisherman and say, "You cast like a bum." Like that.
Okay.
Good. Here we
go. Yeah, you drop the elbow. That's the motion. Good. Better. Good.
It's a very zen experience.
That's Kristen Stimson. Today is her third lesson. She first came across the pools while walking her dog in the park and decided to give it a try. Stimson's friend, Rosanna Rourke, wanted to come too.
I was like, can I please join you and crash your little party? Because I was heading to Montana a couple weeks after, and I wanted to learn before I actually went fly fishing.
In Montana, she caught a trout.
It was amazing. It was about this big.
So pretty.
I gather that it was a young trout, but no criticism from me. Here, I'm as green as it gets.
How many here have never cast a fly rod before?
That would be me. In the pools, there are bright floating rings a few feet across. They're targets to land your fly in. Some people here can hit the target from 100 feet. I'm not concerned about those. I just want the line to go out straight in front of me and not land in a pile by my feet.
There you go. That's it. Good hand position. Nicely done.
It piled up a little bit. Do you see it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now this time, pretend you're trying to hit that sign over there.
Okay.
And you got a paintbrush in this hand, and I got to flick it and go whump and get the paint over there. Okay, now go. Flick that paintbrush. Best cast yet.
I think I'm ready to watch a real fly fisherman cast.
Hey, Ian, how are you?
Remember Mirdad Sabiri? The guy who got me interested in the first place?
Good to see you, man. This is a beautiful bamboo rod that one of our distinguished members has made, and I'm casting it right now.
When Sabiri casts, his shoulder, arm, and wrist move fluidly, and the rest of his body is still. His gaze is always directed on the water, right where he wants the fly to land. And pretty much every time, that's where it lands.
Fly fishing gives you the opportunity to really express all the things you strive for in life and demonstrate it in your cast.
The chance to get better and better is one of the reasons he comes here. It's also a way for him to connect with his Persian culture. Sabiri was born in Iran and moved to San Francisco in 1979 when he was 11.
The Persian culture is heavy duty into poetry. Rumi and Hafez and what have you. And fly fishing and fly casting basically brings the physical elements of sports and sportsmanship and competition and the poetic side of the culture together for me. And it's all an expression of what's in your mind. I'm a sucker for that. I feel it's my temple. You know, I feel meditation. It's my religion, I think.
Sabiri hasn't always felt welcome in the U.S., but here, it's different.
You know, here I am among these incredible people that have all the reasons in the world to be a little reserved. Yet they have absolutely open, welcoming arms, and they judge you by who you are, your character, and your love for the sport. And the sport brings us all together, huddled around, you know, these ponds. So we're lucky to have them here.
And no fish necessary. For Cross Currents, I'm Ian Lewis.
A lot of you knew exactly where we recorded this week. Our winner is Rosny Daniel. Congratulations, Rosny. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. Thanks for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. If you've got ideas for where we should record next, tell us about them at news@kalw.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio.
Want to go home, but I ain't got sufficient clothes. Dog on my bad luck soul. I want to go home, but I ain't got sufficient clothes. Ain't got sufficient talking about clothes. I wanna go home, doggone my bad luck so.
Our team includes Shireen Adil, Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, James Rowlands, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. These voices belong to members of the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir. The choir will be making a joyful noise on Sunday when they're at the Freight and Salvage Coffee House in Berkeley. Music starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.